The Tudor History and Travel Show is a podcast that brings Tudor history to life by exploring Tudor places and artifacts in the flesh. You will be travelling through time with Sarah Morris, the Tudor Travel Guide, uncovering the stories behind some of the most amazing Tudor locations and objects in the UK. Because when you visit a Tudor building, it is only time and not space which separates you from the past. And now over to your host, Sarah Morris.
Hello everyone, it's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide here, broadcasting to all four corners of planet Earth. Yes, wherever you are in the world, you are most welcome to this month's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. Now in a moment, we'll be getting straight on with the show, and we'll be joined by our guide for today, Kevin Winter from the Battlefields Trust, because we're going to be walking around the site of the Battle of Stoke Field, which is widely considered to be the final battle in the epic that was the Wars of the Roses. On this occasion, I was certainly out and about. In fact, I headed to the Midlands, to near a place called Newark, which is a very famous town, famous for its Civil War connections. But actually, it was near the town of Newark that the last battle of the Wars of the Roses took place. This battle was called the Battle of Stoke Field, and it all came about because of the threat from the pretender, Lambert Simnel. And so, on the 16th of June, 1487, Henry VII faced off against the rebels. And this time, some 500 or so years later, it was my turn to walk around the site of the battlefield. And so I met up with our guide, Kevin Winter, who, as I mentioned, is part of the Battlefields Trust, who knows all there is to know about some of these major battles, including that of Stoke Field. And so we had no finer guide for our stroll around the battlefield site. And so you will find me standing in the middle of a field with Kevin as we begin our tour. So put your boots on, we're going for a stroll.
Well, here I am in the middle of Nottinghamshire, I believe, just by Stoke Field, the battlefield of Stoke Field, and I've come here to meet Kevin Winter. Hello, Kevin, thank you so much.
Hi, Sarah.
It's amazing where I find myself, but I'm very grateful for the opportunity to meet you here in the middle of the countryside on what is a glorious sunny August day.
A field in England and almost a forgotten battlefield in some ways.
Yes, indeed, because of course you can contrast that against Bosworth Battlefield, which has a huge visitor centre and is a destination in and of its own right. And I was just thinking that as I was coming up, how the contrast between the two. But you're an expert on Stoke Battle, so perhaps you could tell us a little bit more about who you are and how you come to know so much about the battlefield.
Okay, so I'm chair of the Battlefield Trust in the East Midlands. So we've got three battlefields that are registered. One is Bosworth, second one is Stoke Field, so both Wars of the Roses, and the third one is Winsby, 1643, so Civil War. In addition to that, I'm also the assistant curator at the National Civil War Centre and Newark Museum. And we have got a set of human remains that were found in 1982 from the Battle of Stoke.
And so we're going to be seeing those towards the end of our conversation.
Yeah, so we'll see some of those at least.
So we are starting off literally on the battlefield trail, and we're going to be walking, starting off here where we are now. We're at the beginning of the trail, and in a moment we're going to be talking a little bit about the context of why this battle came about and who were the main participants. And then we're going to take a walk up to, I understand, a place where really the battle took place, and we'll get a fantastic view.
Across the battlefield itself.
Yeah. Brilliant. That's fantastic. Good. Okay, so without further ado, why don't you perhaps help us set the scene? We're talking, 1487,
1487.
Aren't we?
So everybody thinks that the Wars of the Roses ended with Bosworth in 1485, but they didn't. Henry sat uneasily on the throne for at least another few years. And one of the rebellions that he faced was the Simnel Rebellion, which is what we're talking about, the Lambert-Simnel Rebellion.
Perhaps you could just tell us a little bit about that, because there were two pretenders to the Tudor throne, yeah. and Lambert-Simnel was the first one, and then, of course, there was Perkin Warbeck later on. So we're talking about Lambert-Simnel. Now, who was he?
Well, that's a very good question. He appears to have been a young lad, 10 years old, brought up in Oxford, who had a tutor, who was a priest called Robert Simon or Robert Simmons. I'm not quite sure of which. But they thought that there was enough of a resemblance to Edward of Warwick.
And who was Edward of Warwick? For those people who may be coming to this part of history, maybe for the first time.
Yeah, so he's the son of George, Duke of Clarence. So Edward the Fourth's brother, the one who was supposedly drowned in a bottle of Malmsey wine.
Right, got you.
So he was after the princes in the Tower, so he was the next claimant to the Yorkist throne, if you want. So they thought that Simnel bore enough of a resemblance, and Simmons tutored him in the ways of a Yorkist prince so that he could pass himself off as one.
So right from the beginning, they knew that this wasn't the real deal.
Absolutely.
They knew they had an interloper, and they were grooming him, essentially, to fill that role.
Yeah, and Henry VII actually paraded the real Warwick outside the Tower of London.
Ah.
So as the plot started to develop, he paraded him there to say, no, look, this is the real one.
So he was still alive and still in the Tower.
Absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Okay, that's great. So what happened next in terms of the build-up? Where did Lambert-Simnel was brought up in Oxford?
Yeah.
What happened to him?
Well, he is basically a puppet, so for the Yorkist side. So the main protagonist that we've got is the Earl of Lincoln. So John de la Pole, Earl of Lincoln. He is a nephew of both Edward IV and Richard III. And had been supposedly named as heir to Richard III at Bosworth.
Right.
So here's, in effect, your main protagonist. Mm. Francis Lovell is another. Francis Lovell was orphaned when he was 9 years old. He was given into the wardship of the Earl of Warwick and then was brought up with Richard III at Middleham Castle.
Right.
He was knighted by him on a campaign in Scotland. Mm-hmm. And he was one of the people that escaped from Bosworth. In 1486, he led a rebellion and attempted to capture Henry at York, but failed miserably and went off to the continent. And on the continent, you've got Margaret of York. So she is the sister of both Edward IV and Richard III, had been married to Charles the Bold, Duke of Burgundy, and would support anything that would take the Lancastrians off the throne, basically.
Right, yeah. So she provided money, right?
Yes.
Money
and support.
Yeah.
So this is where Lovell and Lincoln find themselves and get that support from her. And she raises the money to raise a mercenary army of Swiss-German mercenaries, led by a man called Martin Schwartz, who'd been born in Augsburg, son of a shoemaker in Augsburg. But he'd come to prominence under Maximilian, the Holy Roman Emperor, and also Charles the Bold. So he brought a force of about 1,500 mercenaries. Now, where they end up is in Dublin, because by this time, Simnel has been taken to Dublin, and the Yorkists are still very popular in Dublin. Richard of York, the father of Edward IV and Richard III, the Grand Old Duke of York, if you want, he had been Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, and had been very popular there.
Oh, I see. Right.
So by taking somebody there who resembled a Yorkist prince and with that support behind him, that gained the support of the Irish. So you end up with around 1,500 to 2,000 Irish kerns, and we can talk a little bit more about those later.
Okay.
And the effect of how poorly armed they were had on the battle. And a number of Yorkists as well. So all of the time that this is going on, Henry is aware that something's going on. So he's taking his forces up through the Earl of Lincoln's main headquarters, which are in Norfolk and Suffolk, parading his army up through there, thinking that any invasion will come from the east.
So when would that have been, Kevin? Because obviously the battle of Stokefield took place on the 16th of June. So yeah. I imagine this is the run-up to...
It is. So in the spring, so Henry is in the east. He realises that the threat is not coming from there. So he stands most of his army down and he bases himself at Kenilworth. So royal castle there.
Right in the middle, right of, in the middle of the navel of England.
Absolutely. So that he can react to whatever happens. I think it's Easter Sunday. I'll need to check on that. Simnel is crowned as Edward V in Dublin Cathedral, supposedly with a crown taken from a statue of the Virgin Mary. And he's paraded through the streets of Dublin on the shoulders of Lord Platon, who's the tallest man around, and there's sort of woodcuts showing him being paraded around. So on the 4th of June, that army arrives in Furness in Cumbria, and they start to make their way across the country. By the 8th of June, they're at Masham in Yorkshire. Lincoln is sort of telling Martin Swartz that he's going to pick up lots of support from the north, which isn't really forthcoming. And they start to make their way down via York. And they send people to York because they're expecting support from York. York shuts its gates to them.
Well, that's surprising, isn't it? Because, of course, this is the stronghold of the Yorkists, yep. Right? York?
Yeah. But no, there is no support coming from York at all. That may be due to the fact that there was a Royalist army under Henry Clifford, fairly close in attendance. But certainly they shut their doors. Yeah. And that sort of influences the way that that army is then going to make their way south. What they're also not doing is picking up any support. Yeah. So Martin Swartz is probably looking at Lincoln now and saying, you know, you were telling me that all these people were going to flock to your banner and it's not happening. You know, why am I here? They make their way south. We're not entirely sure exactly which route they took, but we think they come south in a way that they can pick up provisions, so come via Southwold. And then they end up on the other side of the River Trent at Fiskerton on the night of the 15th, cross and make their camp up on top of Burren Furlong.
It might just be worth saying for those people who are not so familiar with English geography, kind of exactly where this battlefield is in relation to some of those places that you've mentioned and in relation to the geography of England as a whole.
So we're on the River Trent. We're looking at both banks of the River Trent, effectively. So the rebel army have crossed from the north bank onto the south. We're about 3.5 miles from Newark, which is the crossing point of the Fossway and the Great North Road at that time.
Yeah, so strategically quite an important area, isn't it, this area? We were just in Nottingham very recently and talking about the importance of Nottingham as a strategic position, as that kind of interface between the south and the north and commanding the Trent, etc.
During the First English Civil War, so 1642-46, you know, it becomes known as the key to the north.
Right, well, there you go.
So that probably gives you an idea of the strategic importance.
It certainly does.
We're about 14 miles from Nottingham.
And just out of interest, how far are we from the Bosworth battlefield, where Henry, of course, 2 years earlier had taken the crown?
Bosworth were probably looking about 40 miles, probably. So it's not that far, but it's a long way for an army that's making its way around on horseback and on foot.
So what happens next? They are advancing on this very spot, and I presume Henry gets wind that they are close by. He's
absolutely
in Kenilworth at the time, or is he
moved? Henry is already moved by this stage. So he's aware that this army has come across, and he's making his own counter moves. So he makes his move to Leicester, where he's marching quite slowly so that people can flock to him. One of the main people that comes to him is John de Vere, Earl of Oxford, who had been the head of Henry's vanguard at Bosworth and would also be at the head of his vanguard at Stokefield as well.
Right. What do you reckon to Henry, while we're maybe we could touch on this later, but just in case we don't, what do you reckon to Henry as a strategist, a military strategist?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. Having attended quite a lot of Bosworth festivals, and you see the amount of Richard III support that you get there, Henry gets very little support for some reason. Richard III seems to be this romantic character that that people have flocked to, whereas Henry isn't. And people try and put down his military capabilities. Even here, people suggest that Henry watched the battle from Halton Church, which is about 3.5 miles away. We might go past there on the way back into Newark. But that it's very unlikely. And I think that he was involved in that second battle.
You think he personally took part in the battle here at Stoke?
Absolutely, yeah. In the later stages.
Right. Well, that's really interesting, because you do often hear quoted, don't you, that Bosworth Battlefield, and, you know, it's a sort of the last time that kings rode into battle, but maybe not.
No, maybe not. What appears to have happened is De Vere is put in charge of the vanguard. Henry looked after the second battle, and by battle, what we're talking is effectively three separate armies, if you want. The vanguard being the ones that were going first, the main battle being led by Henry, and then a rear guard led by Lord Strange, who are bringing up the rear.
Okay, right. Thank you for that. Now, so back to our story. I meandered a little bit there because my curiosity was taking me into different places. But so the day is coming, I guess.
The day is coming. By this stage, Henry has moved forward. He gets to Nottingham and then moves outside to a place called Bunny. And on the night of the 15th of June, he's at Radcliffe-on-Trent, which is about 4, maybe 5 miles away across to our sort of southwest.
And do we know where he stayed there? Are there records of where he actually stayed?
Certainly there was at Bunny, but not at Radcliffe. On the morning of the battle, he receives two masses, and he's given 5 local guides, which are said to show the ways and bushments. And by bushments, this is ambush places. Uh-huh. So he gives 2 of those to Oxford and keeps the other 3 for himself. And so in the morning of the battle, we get Oxford, John De Vere, setting out along what is known as the Upper Foss, and we'll see that shortly. And Henry and the main battle and the reserve are coming along the main fossway, which is the main road.
Now it's just about, I don't know, about 50 metres away from us, just at the beginning of this track, because we're literally standing on a track that takes you from the fossway, which is the place that you've just been talking about, which was an ancient Roman road originally.
It was an ancient Roman road, possibly an Iron Age road before that.
Okay, and connecting where?
Exeter and southwest to Lincoln.
So, wow, so there's a real east-west. I wish they had such a good east-west connection these days in England. Anyway, so we're literally at the kind of the bottom of this track, and we're going to be making our way with the fossway behind us uphill, because the battle took place, or part of it took place, on towards the top of the hill.
The Rebel Army were established right on top of the hill. Okay. They were in a really good strategic position at that stage.
Yeah, so there's a looking out from me, so I'll just try and describe what I can see. I am literally in the middle of a field with Kevin here, and there's a track in front of us, and it kind of meanders its way gradually up a fairly sort of gentle rise to the hill, to kind of a wooded copse towards the top. And so that's where we're going to be going. Do you think this is a good time to start making our way, or is there anything else we need to know about the kind of the setup of the battle?
No, I think that's probably we've set the scene, I think.
Yeah, so we're ready to walk. So let's go then.
Okay.
Kevin, I can see that we've walked about a quarter of a mile, as I say, gently uphill, and I can see a second of the boards ahead of us. So tell me, What do we know about this particular spot and why is it important?
OK, so we're now at the junction of what is known as Humber Lane, which stretches off to your right, but also links up another road that comes across Syreston Airfield.
And that's over to the left of us, yeah.
It's that track that we think is the Upper Foss.
So that's this, another ancient roadway that existed in the time.
We think probably what it would have been was because the Fossway is down in a valley effectively, so during winter months that would have been quite wet. Oh,
I see.
So the Upper Foss would have been a drier route.
Makes a lot of sense, yeah. So now again we're surrounded by fields and the tracks are literally just sort of gravelly farm tracks now, but that potentially was a roadway for the folks back
probably
in the day.
Not much difference
to how it would be today, no. Now I can imagine.
But this is where De Vere's vanguard, he had around 8,000 men, sorry, around 6,000 men, as opposed to the rebel army of about 8,000. So the rebel army would have been up on top of the hill there, so you can see the clump of trees.
Yeah, so looking over to our right, I don't know, a couple of hundred metres away, there's a clump of trees, so the rebels mustered up there.
Yep.
And so you're saying over to our left we had the Earl of Oxford.
Yes.
Okay, so there's a bit of a standoff going on, but we're at the top, they've both got high ground here.
They have.
So what happens?
But Oxford is still approaching against an army that are on top of a hill. And we think this is about 9 o'clock in the morning. From the reports that we've got, there are a couple of reports that say it was the battle started around 9.
So, Kevin, since you mentioned sources, I was wondering about what contemporary sources we have that tell us about the battle.
Yeah, and here we hit our problem of medieval sources not always being reliable and certainly having a bias. The only one that was anywhere near to the battle is somebody known as the Anonymous Herald. So we don't, as the name suggests, we don't know who he is, but it's clear that he did accompany the Royal Army. He's the only source that gives Lambert Simnel's real name as John, because Lambert Simnel was not his real name. He didn't witness the actual battle, but he was probably kept to the rear. Mm. You then got Polydore Virgil, who was born in Italy around 1470, came to England when his patron, Adriano Costello, was appointed Bishop of Hereford in 1502. He was already a noted author, and Henry VII asked him to produce a new history of England. So the first draft was produced in 1513, so he had access to official documents and eyewitness accounts, but there's the thought that he didn't really understand vernacular English, so being an Italian, and also the fact that he's writing it for Henry, you're going to get a biased account.
Yeah, you are really, aren't you? You're not going to give a really shoddy account for the person who's commissioned you to write it.
Absolutely not. Jean Molinet, he was a chronicler and historiographer to the Dukes of Burgundy. His narrative dates from 1474 until the year before he died in 1507. He gives several insights into the rebellion that aren't mentioned anywhere else, such that Edward Woodville's advance to Doncaster, he then knew that York was not going to declare for the rebels, so he came back through Sherwood Forest and rejoined the King's army the day before the battle.
Okay.
And then Francis Bacon, and he's basing his account on Hall's account on Virgil's account, right. And written much later. So you've really got no contemporary accounts apart from the Anonymous Herald.
Right, so just sort of shards of evidence here and there. So what does the board show us that we have in front of us?
So the board is showing really the way the battle unfolded. So we have the rebel army on the hill behind us.
It's 9 o'clock in the morning, you were saying?
9 o'clock in the morning. So Oxford is approaching from that direction, so from the west. And the rebels sort of see their opportunity. They see that they might have a smaller army, but a smaller army was successful at Bosworth. So they see, right, if we come down off the hill and take on Oxford's vanguard, maybe we can put them into flight, get them into panic, going back down the Fossway against the main battle, and that's our best chance of getting a result.
I see. So they wanted to create a really early momentum that would hopefully swing the rest of the battle in their favour. I see. Right, OK. And did it work? That's the question, I guess.
Certainly not in the way that they expected. Okay. And this is partly because of the way that the army is made up. So we've got Irish Kearns, who are poorly armoured. I'll show you a picture in a bit, but basically, they're great for guerrilla warfare in the hills of Ireland.
Right.
Against a medieval army in plate armour, they're not going to be so successful.
So they were poorly armed, both in terms of armour and in terms of weaponry,
yeah.
I guess?
Yeah, absolutely. So big axes, you know, big battle axes that they could swing, knives, which, you know, as I say, great for guerrilla
ambush,
warfare.
Ambush, I guess. Yeah.
But not on a battlefield.
Mm, yeah.
So you do have Schwartz's Lanzknechts, who are the centre part of that army, we think. We think that it's made up with Lincoln on the right wing, Schwartz in the middle, and Fitzgerald's Irish on the left. Those Lanzknechts are well armoured. They have huge swords called Zweihanders, two-handed swords. Smaller swords. They probably had crossbows, and they may have had some sort of gunpowder weapons as well.
Was that quite unusual at that stage in terms of firearms?
It's starting to come in. So we see it at Bosworth, and it's starting to come in onto battlefields, but it's still in its infancy.
And so the main weaponry was what, swords, and I imagine arrows, bows and arrows?
Yeah, certainly for the Royal Army, that is their most successful weapon. So the English stroke Welsh archer, we're only talking 70 years after Agincourt, effectively.
Right, of course. It's really you can be so easy to lose the timing, actually, but it's really not that much, is it? And of course, we were renowned for winning Agincourt because of the longbow.
Because of the longbow,
yeah.
And that's what has the effect, particularly on the poorly armoured Irish. So there are reports of the Irish being shot through like hedgehogs.
Right.
So you can imagine the arrows sticking out of their bodies. You know.
Yikes.
That's the impression that you get. And it appears to have been a fairly closely fought battle, at least to start with. And, you know, we think of medieval battles going, you know, people swinging around in full armour. You can't do that for 3 hours at a time.
Mm.
You break off, you go back, you rest, and then you re-go. And that appears to have happened. It appears to have happened over a sort of period of time as Henry's main battle are approaching along the Foss.
Okay, so you mentioned, you know, the first clash between De Vere and the rebels on the top of this hill. And then when does Henry come into the picture then?
We think it's quite late. So we know that the archers are having that effect, and that appears to wheel the army, the rebel army, back towards the top of the hill. And we think it's probably the addition of Henry's reinforcements that then really force the issue.
Right.
And put the rebel army into rout.
Okay, right. And so do we need to walk on to get the picture of the next stage, which is the rout, as you were saying?
Yes. If we move to the top of the hill, we get a really good idea of just how we've come up a fairly shallow slope. When we get to the top of the hill, we can just see how it drops away as an escarpment.
Okay.
And the effect that would have had on the fleeing army.
Because you just don't see it from here at all.
No.
It looks like you've got flat fields ahead of you, almost as far as the eye can see. So I'm looking forward to this. So,
and you can't see the river at all.
Yeah. Not at all. No, it's just blue sky. It's field and blue sky, and that's all. So maybe we should go and investigate. I'd like to see that.
That sounds good.
Cool.
Thank you.
So, Kevin, we're coming towards the end of the next segment of our walk.
Yes.
And I can see how, I see what you mean, the scenery is just opening up before us.
Yep.
And we're clearly, as you said, on top of an escarpment that drops away before it rises on the other side of a valley.
Yeah, and very shortly, as we start to go down this this hill, you'll be able to see the River Trent running through the bottom.
I see. So again, maybe you could talk to us about why, you know, what is particularly relevant about this topography of the land in relation to the battle.
Yeah, so once the rout starts, then the rebel army is going to have to flee back over the top of this.
Because they've got nowhere else to go, right? The other
absolutely.
They're surrounded.
Yeah, and they're probably going to try and make their way to the ford at Fiskerton that they crossed the day before.
Uh-huh.
That would have been their escape to the north again. So it's as they're running down this hillside, trying to escape, the next place that we'll go to, known as the Red Gutter, becomes poignant because this is where supposedly it ran red with blood.
Oh, I did read about this. This sounds awful. Oh my goodness, we really are now coming over the brow of the hill, and what a beautiful scene in front of me, just fields and trees and patchwork, because it's with it being August, we've got some green fields that have just been used for the grass, but we've got the kind of the yellow of the hay, and it's the harvest going on, and then a beautiful little village with some gorgeous looking houses.
Well,
what are we seeing in front of us?
You can see the white building there.
I can indeed.
That's the Bromley Arms at Fiskerton, and that's where we think the ford over the Trent would have been.
Ah, so that's where the army was heading for, and I can see a glimpse of the River Trent, the mighty River Trent.
And you can hear it, because it actually runs much closer to us before then going round in almost an oxbow, round towards Fiskerton, and then coming back round towards very close to Stoke. But the river at that stage was probably a lot shallower, probably more braided, so there would have been more channels. So it would have been easier for an army to cross. We know that there was a Roman ford at Hazelford, which is just down to our left at the bottom of the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And that linked Southwell, which is over in the distance over there, with a Roman town of Adpontem, which is East Stoke Thorpe, so very close to here. So there are a couple of crossing points where the army might have crossed, but we think Fiskerton is the most likely. And it's that they're trying to get back to. Now, if you can imagine that you're trying to flee down this hill in armour or in jerkins with somebody behind you, it's not going to be the most easiest of jobs.
No, it certainly isn't. No, and of course you're being chased, aren't you?
And you're being chased.
So you're running for your life.
Yeah.
Arrows flying all over the place, no doubt. And that's quite tricky.
And then you get to the bottom and you have to cross the river. And if you fall over the river in plate armour or in a padded jerkin, what happens? You get dragged down and you drown. So over the 2 days after the battle, total casualties are about 7,000. So there are more casualties here than there are at Bosworth. Thank you.
Right, so from here, I'm intrigued because the path kind of winds down the hill and I think you want to take us to the Red Gutter.
Yeah, we're going to go to the Red Gutter.
Right, let's go and see it. I've got a feeling this is going to be quite sort of atmospheric and emotional to think about all these people who died here.
And you will get an impression again of, as we go down towards the river, how close it is here and then how far it is as you look across the Fiskerton.
Yes, because as I'm looking at it now, the river looks, I don't know, about a mile away, know, but it's I can hear the river.
Absolutely, yeah. It is literally at the bottom of the hill. Okay, so there's the river.
God, that is surprising. It really does loop round, doesn't it?
It does, yeah.
And it's right down at the foot of the escarpment. So.
And what you can hear is the weir at Hazelford and Hazelford Locks.
And it is quite steep. I mean, I'm having to put the brakes on. I'm just walking down this hill. I don't have an army chasing me with longbows.
No.
And I'm not, certainly not wearing armour. But yeah, you really do have to put the brakes on. So there's quite a gradient going on here.
It is, yeah. It's very surprising when you come from just that gentle slope on the other side.
On the side, yeah. So what generally happened in these battles when the tide turned and one side realised that they were probably on the losing side? Did the commander often give the command to run for your life, basically, or did people just desert and that's how it kind of ended?
I think that's essentially what would have happened. So you've got the Irish are being cut to pieces. So that's having the effect of sort of wheeling the flank. Mm. The Lansknechts probably would have been, you know, putting up a pretty good fight. The Yorkist army, the Yorkist rebels, they probably realise that, you know, everything's up. Mm. And they're going to try and save their lives, basically.
Yeah. It's very hard to imagine the noise and commotion on these battlefields when you come to them today.
Yeah.
When you've got birdsong and sounds of weirs on the river and the wind, and that's really all the sound that you've got.
And you would have had, you know, the clash of weapons and
shouts and
the groans of dying men.
So well, we're right down at the bottom as far as we can go around.
Yes.
We're right next to the river. And so we're looking back up the field, back up the escarpment, which we've just walked down. And you really do get a view of the gradient here and what was facing those troops.
Yeah, we've got trees off to our left, but it's quite probable that those trees weren't there at the time.
So it was just an open field.
Yeah.
Right. Well, let's move on.
We'll stop here.
Okay.
So basically, in the woods there, this is what's known as the Red Gutter.
Right, okay.
I'll show you a picture from 1987.
And while you're doing that, maybe I could just describe. We've walked from the river across another field at the bottom of the escarpment. And as you pointed out, part of that is now wooded, but may not have been wooded back in the day when this battle happened. So maybe you could just explain to us, you mentioned before about the Red Gutter, but maybe you could talk to us a little bit more detail about its relevance to the battle.
Yeah, so we have basically a very steep escarpment, which you can't see for the trees.
Lock it out.
But it's certainly there. And in 1987, when the 500 years commemorations were there, there was a trowel around the battlefield, and I'm just trying to find a picture, but there were steps put in, so you can see there.
Oh yes, right, okay. So there'll be a show notes page as usual associated with this podcast, with some photos I've taken on the day, and also some of the photos that Kevin's describing to us right now about what the Red Gutter looks like.
Mm-hmm.
So the steps were put in, and as you can see, yes, it's quite a steep escarpment. And what happened here?
Well, this is where supposedly it ran red with blood.
So there must have been, a funnel of men almost got trapped in
here? So the fleeing army are coming off that steep escarpment. They're being pursued. They're tripping over themselves, trying to get down to the river crossing, which is behind us. And they're being cut down by the pursuers. Mm. There is an alternative. The clay underneath is red Cooper Mile clay.
Okay.
So, as ever, battlefields have their slash hollows and bloody meadows and all the rest of it. So there are all these apocryphal stories of places associated with the battle, and this might be one of them.
I see. Yes, well, every battlefield has to have one, doesn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
Yes, but nevertheless, we're still in that range where men would have been slaughtered, but as we're saying, whether it actually did run red with blood, might be a slight over-exaggeration on that point.
Well, that's certainly the story that the locals would like to tell you.
And let them tell it, that's what I say.
Why not? Nothing wrong with a bit of good local tradition.
Lovely, great. So, shall we continue on? I see you've got another one of your
boards. There is another board.
So that's telling the story of the Red Gutter, I guess.
It is, yeah.
So we just have to walk a little way further along, and there's another of the Battlefield Trail storyboards that you can catch up with the story and read what went on here for yourself. I see we're here in front of the board, and you've entitled this "The End of the Battle," and you've got the picture of the escarpment and the rebel army, how they initially pressed forward and then obviously had to retreat down the escarpment.
Mm-hmm. And also fleeing on both sides as well. So although a big part of the army would have come back down the escarpment, some would have been fleeing down onto the other side of the hill as well, which is where some of the mass graves were found in later years.
And so what happened after the battle? Did any of the rebel lords escape? Were they all slaughtered on the battlefield?
Lincoln, Schwartz and Fitzgerald were all killed. The only leading commander was Francis Lovell, who escaped. And there's lots of apocryphal stories about what happened to him as well.
Yes, because there's a bit of a mystery around that.
There is.
What are the stories?
Well, he's said to have been seen crossing the river on his horse. We know that he had estates in Nottinghamshire, so it's possible that he went there. A few years after the battle, there was an act of retainer against him, and there is records of him taking refuge in Scotland. But then after that, he just disappears. But at Minster Lovell, which was his former estate, in the 18th century, somebody came across a walled-up room. And in the walled-up room was a man sat at a desk, or the skeleton of a man sat at a desk with writing equipment around him. Now, at that stage, Minster Lovell would have been given to his opponents. So would he really have gone back there and been bricked in? We can't say. But there is that mystery.
Yes, well, I actually live very close to Minster Lovell, so I know the place well and I know the story well. And I think what you're pointing out there is the last place he's likely to go are to his well-known estates. I would have thought.
I would have thought so too.
Because, of course, the king would have sent people to all of those places to try and find him. But what a mystery. I love a good mystery.
Yeah. And the other one is Lambert Simnel. Yeah. Because Lambert Simnel is captured after the battle.
Was he present at the battle?
Yes, but almost certainly. Whether he took up that leading position in front of the army, probably not. He is only 10 years old at this stage. So,
but he has to be there as a figurehead, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. But once he's captured, it's interesting what the king does to him. He could easily have had him executed, but he doesn't. He spares him. He becomes a turnspit in the royal kitchen. And there are later records, which we're fairly sure are him, and he's become a falconer.
I actually think that's the stroke of genius on the part of Henry VII, isn't it?
Yeah.
He puts him well and truly in his place without creating the aggro of making him some kind of martyr for the Yorkist cause. I think he was pretty shrewd, Henry VII.
I think so. His one regret over all of this was that Lincoln was killed. He would have liked him to have been captured so that he could have found what other plots. But dead men tell no tales.
Of course.
Where Lincoln was killed is just across the Fossway, at a place called the Willow Rundle.
Ah, so we know that. That's interesting. How do we know? Is that accounted for in one of the documents? Obviously, it must be.
Well, there's certainly, again, accounts, whether they can be believed or not, that he was buried there with a willow stake through his heart. Again, whether that's true or not, we don't know. The Willow Rundle itself, there was a spring there until fairly recently when the A46 was duelled, when it dried up. But apparently it came up because a dying soldier was there, prayed to his god for water, and a spring came up. And the willow trees are still there, so the willow trees can still be seen. Mm. What does remain, and I've still not seen it yet, is John de la Pole's sword, which is at Lincoln Guildhall, apparently.
Is it now? Now I'm frustrated because I was only in Lincoln a week ago, but I wasn't. We did look at the Guildhall and didn't appear to be open, but that is something to...
Yeah.
That's a quest, isn't it? For all of you out there, you connoisseurs of the Wars of the Roses and the Tudor period, there's a challenge that I'm throwing down to you. Can you actually get into the Guildhall and see John de la Pole's sword and post a photo on my social media? Because I would like to see it. Well, you've certainly thrown down the gauntlet for me. Very good. So, yes, carry on. What else?
We'll leave this board and we'll head on up towards Stoke Hall, which obviously wouldn't have been there at the time. But we can talk there about some of the bodies that were found in 1982.
Let's do that. Let's go. Yeah. Aha, I see a church.
St. Oswald's Church.
Some grand looking gates.
Mm-hmm.
And then another one of your
another
boards
panel.
Here.
Yep.
So, what's this one telling us about, Kevin?
So this one is talking about some of the battlefield finds, so in the centuries afterwards. Certainly in the 19th century, there were a number of mass burials found around the village itself, on the outskirts of the village.
Ah, right.
But in 1982, workmen digging a drainage ditch on the Fossway came across several bones, which we thought at the time were 11. But since then, archaeological analysis has shown us that there are 9 partial human remains there. So they're the ones that we'll see some of
in the museum.
When we go to the museum.
I wouldn't mind just reading out for everybody one of the quotes you've got on the board from Jean Molinet,
yep.
circa 1490. And it says, "There died the Earl of Lincoln, most noble and renowned in arms, Sir Martin Schwartz, a most enterprising knight and of greatest courage, along with numerous notable people in such great number that the whole army only, of the whole army to only 200 escaped, of whom those in the 2 days following who were found to be Irish and English were hanged, and those who were foreigners were dismissed."
The English Yorkist rebels were treated as exactly that, as rebels, and hunted down. The Irish were also hunted down, although many of them would have been killed on the battlefield. But because they were mercenaries and they might come in useful, Schwartz's mercenaries weren't allowed to go.
So yeah, they were basically... Well, I suppose technically they're not guilty of treason, are they?
No, no, they're not. And yeah. you might want to employ them.
Yeah, at some of the points. So, yes.
So
very
it makes sense.
Very forward thinking, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, I guess in the heart of hearts, they didn't really care who won, really. They were just doing a day
being
of work. They're
paid for doing their job. Yeah.
It makes a lot of sense, even though it's all still quite gruesome to think of the pursuit of these people and their subsequent executions, having gone through such a harrowing day in the first instance.
Yes.
Good. Okay. Well, I think you wanted to take us up to the church.
Yes.
It's always good. I always recommend to you folks out there, listeners who are coming to the UK, particularly if you know you are coming to the UK and you're not maybe so familiar with England. You must, if you come to any of the small villages or towns, do check out the local parish church, because you can always find some really interesting things, and you really might find something very interesting, an old medieval tomb or some history that you just simply weren't expecting, medieval wall paintings. It can be an absolute treasure trove, and it's a real sense of adventure. I always find going into any new graveyard and sort of pushing open the door of the church, and you get that lovely creak as you open it, and you just don't know what's going to be inside. The parish church of St. Oswald's, East Stoke, which is the village that we're closest to, I guess.
It is indeed, yep. Here we go.
So you were mentioning there about mass graves near the local village. So generally speaking, they did take the time, didn't they? First of all, to take any items of value off the dead bodies.
Yes.
But then they were buried. They weren't just left. And I guess that was for hygiene reasons as much as anything.
I think so. Yeah, I mean, June... So you're coming into summer. We're not entirely sure what the weather was like at the time. But you can imagine leaving...
thousands of bodies.
7,000 bodies.
Yeah, not good.
It's... No. And so we come to a memorial.
See, yes. So we just outside the church by the tower, there's a stone memorial. And it says, "To commemorate the dead at Stoke Field, 16th of June, 1487. And then we have the names of John de la Pole, Earl of Lincoln, Sir Thomas Geraldine, Colonel Martin Schwartz, and 7,000 others, English, Irish, and German." So it's very touching. And was the Battlefield Trust responsible for...
No, that was put up again for the 500th anniversaries in 1987.
Lovely.
But it's a fitting place to sort of end... The Battlefield tour, effectively.
It is, isn't it? Yeah, it's a sense of completion and a moment of reflection, maybe, as well. I just think they're incredibly brave, these men. They must have known that the chances of dying a horribly, grisly, painful death were extremely high.
Now, there are traditions that these marks on the wall were from people sharpening their swords on it before the battle.
Oh, really?
But, again... Nice story.
Nice story. So, Kevin, we've actually driven from the site of the battlefield. Yep. How many miles to nearby Newark?
So it's about 3.5 miles.
And can you just maybe just tell people about the importance of Newark as a town in the day and why it was important?
So by that period, we had a castle here, which had been built as a bishop's palace in 1135. One of the things that happened when that palace was built as well was a bridge was built across the River Trent. And that meant the Great North Road was diverted. Previously, it went up through Grantham, Lincoln, and up to the Humber. But that meant that it could then be diverted, so you no longer had to get a ferry across the Humber.
Right.
So Newark then becomes a crossing point of both the Great North Road and the Fosway.
Wow, so really important.
Yep.
Right, OK. Now, we've come here because we're at the Palace Theatre, but there's also a museum here as well. And you've come to show me a few things. Maybe you want to tell us about where we are and what we're looking at.
This is where I work. I'm the assistant curator here. So this is the National Civil War Centre and Newark Museum. And we're in the Newark Gallery. So this is the bit that's looking around at the history of Newark, effectively. And what we have are a couple of the human remains that were found in 1982 in that drainage ditch along the Fosway.
And again, I'll put some images of these so people can see what we're looking at.
Yep.
But the most obvious thing, of course, is a very broken, shattered skull.
And you can't really see it from the side, but if you come round onto the back, you can see a huge hole in the back of his head.
So somebody has come at him with some kind of very sharp implement.
Yeah, so maybe something like a war hammer. So something with a spike that's gone right through the back of the skull. Also above his left ear, that's been cut as well. So, you know, there's multiple injuries on that skull, all that would have been received during the battle. And there's also an ulna, so an arm bone. And you can see a notch in that bone. Which is basically a defensive wound. So somebody's put their arm up to defend against a bladed weapon, and it's cut right through through and into the bone.
So you mentioned that some other bodies were found. Where are they kept?
They're all at our resource centre, which is where I spend a fair bit of my time, and there's our museum store. So we've got 95,000 objects in the collection, of which these human remains are a small part of that.
So how do people come here? Because if they're coming to see the battlefield, then they may well want to come into Newark, not least because I imagine there's some nice places to eat and drink and take refreshment, including your very own cafe.
Including our own cafe, where we've just had our own lunch. But in the marketplace itself, there's cafes and everything all the way around the town. There's parking for the National Civil War Centre signposted, some of which can be on the other side of the river, but it's a 10-minute walk from there. Through the marketplace and past the castle.
Well, that's right. I mean, Newark is a relatively small town, but it packs such a punch in terms of its history.
It does.
With the castle and the battlefield, and you've got a beautiful church as well. So there's lots to see here.
Yeah. As you mentioned, the church, there is something there that you might like to see, and that's a stained glass window. Which commemorates the battle and Henry's visit after the battle.
Well, it'd be rude not to, I think, Kevin.
Absolutely.
I think we need to go. So, Kevin, we've come just a few minutes' walk, really.
Literally across the road from from the Civil War Centre.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we're inside this rather stunning church. Is it a parish church?
It is just a parish church. St Mary Magdalene parish church.
It's really quite large, quite magnificent. And at the end, at the east end, we're standing now before a large stained glass window.
Yep.
What relevance does this have?
So in the right-hand panel, you can see the Tudor rose and a reference to Henry and a sword. So this is a commemoration of Henry having come to Newark in commemoration of those lives that had been lost after the battle. It then went on to Lincoln, following the battle at Stoke.
Oh, did he? Right. Okay.
But he came here first and would have heard a Thanksgiving mass here first.
In this church?
Mm-hmm.
Of course he would, wouldn't he? A Te Deum would have been sung, I am sure. So we can see his coat of arms there, can't we, in right in the bottom. So again, this is another challenge for you listeners. If you do come, you need to make your way to the parish church at Newark, which is a beautiful little town. Full of flowers, which I always like. It's really well cared for, and some lovely grounds surrounding the church, lovely parkland, and then the church itself. So your challenge is to find the stained glass window associated with Henry VII with his coat of arms. Wonderful. I mean, we should just mention, really, because Newark is perhaps most famous. You've talked about the Civil War Centre, the National Civil War Centre. Yep. Maybe we just should say, just for the record, that Newark really is most famous from a Civil War point of view.
It is. It was the Royalist stronghold in the East Midlands and held out all the way from 1642 to 1646. Besieged three times. Last siege lasted 6 months.
So you will see, if you do come to Newark, not least in the National Civil War Centre, lots about the Civil War Trail. And I've seen them as I've been
walking
around.
And all the way around the town, there's buildings associated with the Civil War around the town. Yeah. And also at the Queen's Sconce, probably the best preserved earthwork, 17th century earthwork anywhere in the country.
OK, so if you love your Tudor history and your Stuart history, Newark has to be right up there on the places to visit.
Yeah, come and see us.
Yeah, indeed. OK, thank you so much for showing us the church, Kevin. That's wonderful.
OK.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of our trail. I can only thank you so much for meeting us here and
taking pleasure.
Us on this walk. Just so that people have a feel, for how long do you think the entire walk is?
It's probably about an hour and a half.
Yeah, so it's very manageable.
It is, yeah.
You probably want to be wearing, unlike me, so I arrived so excited to be here, jumped out of the car, forgot to put my walking boots on, so I have entirely inappropriate footwear on. But if you do come on the walk, particularly if it's not in the height of summer and it hasn't been dry for some significant period of time, you might want to walk some nice, sturdy, waterproof boots.
Certainly at the bottom of the escarpment, it can be wet.
Yeah, so that's just a little note to those of you who maybe want to come along here and do the walk for yourself. And it's also very dog-friendly, so if you have
definitely.
A four-legged friend, a great place to bring a dog. There's no livestock around, you've just got tracks and open fields, so very good for that too.
And there's a trail leaflet.
So
there's a Heritage Trail leaflet, which is downloadable from Notts County Council. It's also accessible via the Battleford Stratton Resource Centre. So if you find the Butler Stoke Field on there, there is a link to be able to download those leaflets.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you've handed over to me some the Battle of Stoke Field leaflets. It's a self-guided heritage trail. So this is going to help you get around the trail and find out what's going on at each of the different boards. And I can see that there is a URL here for www.nottinghamshire.gov.uk/Battle of Stoke Field. So I guess people can sign on to that. And of course, I'll include a link to that and any other necessary resources in the show notes, which will accompany this podcast alongside those images that I've already mentioned. Is there anything else you'd like to tell us about how people can find out more about the Battlefield Trust or even, in fact, events that you might have going on?
So the Battlefield Trust website has details of all the events that are happening throughout the year. This is obviously only one of many registered battlefields across the country. And there are events going on all the way through the summer and even through the winter. We do walks through the winter for those hardy souls that want to come out and visit the battlefields. But for us, I think, and hopefully for you as well, it's only really by seeing the terrain that these battles have been fought over that you really get an understanding of what was going on and what those people were experiencing.
Yeah, well, absolutely.
So, you know, please log on to the Battlefield Trust website, have a look at our resource centre. You've got all of the battles on there. You can find out more. There's maps and there's often guidance on how to get to each of those trails and suggested walks around them as well.
Well, that's perfect. So I think with that, all that remains for me to say is thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Before we finish the show, remember you can support my work via my Patreon programme, where various levels of sponsorship are available, starting at just $1 a month. Check out all the details of how to become a patron in the link included with this podcast. Oh, and don't forget, you can be part of my closed Facebook group where fellow time travellers like you hang out with me and each other to share some of our favourite things about visiting the UK. From great Tudor places to visit, to the best way to take your cream tea in an afternoon. From the latest travel news to the traditional Sunday roast. So don't miss out, and you can apply to join by clicking on the link in the description. So now it's back to close the show. Well, I so enjoyed my walk around the site of Stoke Battlefield and, of course, the nearby town of Newark. I hope it's inspired you to go and see another battlefield. Of course, we all know of Bosworth Battlefield and its major visitor centre, which attracts so many visitors. But if you want to get away from the crowds, and I know many of you love to get away from tourist traps and see something a little bit different, well then, the site of Stoke Battlefield is the place for you, my friends. And equally, if you go into Newark, you must make sure that you drop by the museum and the church, which is splendid. But also, make sure you head for the marketplace. You cannot miss it. For tucked away in the corner is a very old building. Now, this was once a coaching inn. And upon the site of that inn was another inn called the Hart Inn. And this is, in fact, where Margaret Tudor lodged on her way to Scotland in order to marry the King of the Scots. So it is believed that the current building isn't the original building, although it looks old enough to be so, you cannot miss it. But anyway, yeah, if you like those little tiny details, and I know you do because I've been talking to many of you about what you love about the Tudor Travel Guide of late, then make sure that you head into the Market Square when you visit Newark. Okay, my friends, I think we're done for this month's show. Next month, we are going to be returning to the capital, and I'm going to be sharing with you one of my most favourite adventures from last year, my visit to Sutton House in Hackney, once the home of Sir Ralph Sadler, who is a very suave individual, and he built himself a very swanky townhouse in Hackney called Brick Place. And it was my delight and pleasure to go and explore it last year, a place that I had never been to before. So I hope that you can join me for next month's show. All right, my friends, thank you so much for your company on our stroll around the English countryside. I do hope you enjoyed it. And I so look forward to seeing you again on our next Tudor road trip. Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Tudor History and Travel Show. If you've loved the show, please take a moment to subscribe, like, and rate this podcast so that we can spread the Tudor love. Until next time, my friends, all that remains for me to say is happy time travelling.